From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At the Supreme Court in Washington at this hour, a prayer service scheduled for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. His flag-draped coffin headed up the marble steps for public viewing until tomorrow's funeral. Rehnquist died Saturday at age 80 after a hard fight with thyroid cancer. He had served on the nation's highest court for 33 years and led it for 19. Yesterday, President Bush nominated John Roberts to succeed Rehnquist as Chief Justice. Roberts accepted the nomination and paid tribute to Rehnquist.
I am honored and humbled by the confidence that the President has shown in me, and I'm very much aware that if I am confirmed, I would succeed a man I deeply respect and admire.
Just last month, the President had tapped Roberts to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor, who has announced she is ready to retire. Now, the President has two vacancies to fill, and John Roberts aimed at the court's top job. The last session of the High Court alone produced 5-4 rulings on the death penalty for juvenile offenders, government seizure of private property, two rulings on the displays of Ten Commandments in public places, and more. At the ripe young age of 50, John Roberts could shape the court for decades, and he is now just half the story. This hour on point, the end of the Rehnquist era, a double opening on the Supreme Court, and the nomination of John Roberts for Chief Justice. You can join the conversation. Can you feel the ground moving under the high court? And what are your hopes, your fears for a Roberts court? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington Law School and longtime Supreme Court watcher. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So here we are at this moment. We see Supreme Court justices assembled at the Supreme Court, the casket of William Rehnquist about to be taken out of a hearse there and up the steps of the court. The likely emotions of this very diverse court on this day, Jonathan Turley, you've watched them for a long time.
Well, you know, a lot of people I don't think understand how well-liked Rehnquist was by his colleagues, including his most liberal colleagues. These are people who went through the Warren Burger years and were not entirely happy with his style. Despite the fact that Rehnquist was a committed conservative and ideologically to the right of virtually all of his colleagues at one point or the other, he was deeply trusted as sort of a fair and honest broker as Chief Justice. The other thing is that even for those people that disagreed with the direction he took the court, this is a remarkable American life. You know, when he was a child, he was asked what he wanted to do and with his life, and he said, "I want to change the country." And he did, really. I mean, it's a remarkable thing that a child can say that and do it. And he changed the court and changed many aspects of this country.
Though a view from the conservative side that after all these years of Republican presidents appointing justices, the court did not become as conservative as many conservatives would like.
Well, in fact, William Rehnquist surprised many. He was not as consistent as many people make him out to be. On occasion, he would bolt from the right, but largely he was consistent on most issues. And there was a frustrating element, particularly with Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy, that he never did secure a reliable and consistent conservative majority. But with the players that he had, he changed a lot. And in fact, he went from being the person they called the Lone Ranger on the court because of his opposition to many of the Warren Court doctrines to becoming really the face of the court. I mean, many of those doctrines that he criticized were either dramatically reduced or overturned.
A World War II veteran, his remains will rest in Arlington National Cemetery. We're going to look at the legacy of William Rehnquist and the nominee to succeed him, John Roberts. But help us with some of the nuts and bolts here, Jonathan Turley, if you'd be good enough. How is this likely to unfold in the coming weeks? President Bush seems intent on, if I've got this right, filling Rehnquist's seat with John Roberts before he even turns now to the second seat, Sandra Day O'Connor's at this point.
That's right, and there's certainly a logic to that. The court does need a Chief Justice, but more importantly, if he didn't do that, the acting Chief Justice would be John Paul Stevens. And if many conservatives in this city woke up and found John Paul Stevens as the acting Chief Justice, the ultimate liberal on the court, they'd be throwing themselves off the Memorial Bridge. I mean, that is something that none of these conservatives are willing to face.
And he would be acting Chief Justice on the basis of seniority on the court?
That's right. And they're not going to let that happen, even though the Chief Justice does not have the concentrated authority that the title might suggest. But John Roberts is a brilliant political move for the White House. He is profoundly conservative. And more importantly, he is very young. So this is a person who will be on the court likely for decades. So the court may move to the left. Congress may move to the left. The White House may move to the left. The country may move to the left. But there will remain a profoundly conservative Chief Justice.
Is there any doubt that Congress will cooperate with the president's timetable here? Do the Democrats, I don't know if they would have a desire to slow this down, but is it possible for them to drag their feet so that the two hearings on the two nominees, the two vacancies, overlap?
You know, Tom, I've actually given up trying to figure out what the Democrats are doing. I mean, they have that look of a deer in the headlights since this thing began. There's no coherent leadership, control, message coming out of the Democrats, which is bizarre because they started out this term wisely. They held a summit on how they were going to deal with these court vacancies. And a lot of us said, you know, that's smart because the one thing you learn from Bork is the first few days of a nomination are key.
Mm-hmm.
But it has just fallen apart. I mean, there's no coherence to it. And so you have the Democratic voters and organizations who are spoiling for a fight, and Democratic senators seem to be the exact opposite. They seem to be hoping for this thing to get over very, very quickly, and no one quite understands what's going on in their ranks. But I think it's part and parcel to the fact that the Democrats just don't seem to have much of a coherent organization on this or other issues.
At this moment, Jonathan Turley, the coffin of the deceased Chief Justice William Rehnquist has just been taken up the marble steps of the Supreme Court building. The associate judges, justices of the court, Sandra Day O'Connor, and right on down the line, standing watching the coffin go past, pallbearers, former aides and clerks to the Chief Justice, among others. I want to turn now, if I may, to Minneapolis. Patrick Schiltz joins us. He's professor and founding dean of the University of St. Thomas College of Law in St. Paul. In 1986, he clerked for Justice Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. Knows John Roberts very well. Patrick Schiltz, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Nice to be with you.
It's early days, the Chief Justice only dying Saturday night, but people have been anticipating this moment for a long time now. How would you characterize his era, the era of William Rehnquist as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the face of the court that emerged during that time?
Well, like Jonathan, the thing that I am most struck by is probably not something that the public is too much in tune to, and that is I clerked there, and I clerked there the first year that Chief Justice Rehnquist became chief, and I can remember the palpable sense of relief. They're almost a celebratory sense among not just the conservative judges, but people like Justice Marshall and Justice Brennan. They had so much affection for Chief Justice Rehnquist. He was such an honest guy, so well liked by his colleagues. And he ran a magnificent court. This court is probably the most cohesive, efficient, gets-along best court of the 20th century, and that's largely because of him.
So as a manager and a maybe conciliator, or he did very well, what about the political complexion of the court and its decisions, the judicial face that emerged under Rehnquist?
Well, I tend to be of the school that I think people overestimate the impact that a Chief Justice has on those. These are nine ferociously independent individuals, and it isn't like the chief walks down the hall and convinces them to change their votes. It with rare exceptions like Brown versus Board of Education, it just isn't the way it works. And you can see that in the Rehnquist court. I mean, I was trying to think last night if I could think of a major conservative victory won on a hot button issue over the last 3 or 4 years, and it's very hard to think of one. You know, the conservative victories have mainly come in areas of federalism and in criminal procedure. But on the hot button issues of the day, abortion, affirmative action, gay rights, it's very hard to think of a recent conservative victory.
Jonathan Turley, do you see that now poised to change with two openings on the court, with John Roberts, profoundly conservative, as you say, headed into the top seat very likely? Will we see a more conservative court, even on the hot button issues where Patrick Schilt says he hasn't seen the impact?
Well, I think we will, and I agree entirely with Patrick that Rehnquist was not, you know, someone who would strong arm or try to steer his colleagues in any way than a persuasive fashion. That distinguishes him from Earl Warren, who was a real politician. Earl Warren would, you know, go in there and talk to his colleagues and try to win them over and do everything but promise them a highway bill, you know, and that was where he cut his teeth. He was a very political type of guy. Rehnquist is not like that, and I think that his colleagues appreciated it. But now that we have Roberts, I think what you're going to see is a conservative majority emerge that is indeed stable, because he's obviously going to replace another conservative. I think his views are very close to Rehnquist. I don't honestly believe there'll be people to the right to him on the court. I think that he is a someone who has a clear judicial philosophy, and that's to his credit.
Even Scalia, even Thomas not to the right of him, we'll have to come back and explore that. Jonathan Turley at George Washington University, Patrick Schiltz at St. Thomas College of Law, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. Dignitaries, family, and friends now gathered in the Great Hall of the Supreme Court, where the remains of Chief Justice William Rehnquist lie in state on the Lincoln catafalque, the same structure that Abraham Lincoln lay in state on all those years ago. We are talking this hour about the end of the Supreme Court's Rehnquist era and the John Roberts nomination as Chief Justice. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the end of the Supreme Court's Rehnquist era and two seats open now on the U.S. High Court. Behind me, the sound of a memorial service underway in the Great Hall of the Supreme Court. All the remaining justices apparently gathered there, as well as friends and family, including what would appear to be grandchildren in tears, at the side of the coffin of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who died on Saturday at 80 after a tough fight with thyroid cancer. He leaves behind a country divided over the proper future of the court and its rulings, a president determined to put in solid conservatives, John Roberts now nominated to be a Supreme Court Chief Justice to replace Rehnquist. Let's listen for just a moment. There's the end.
Hear us now, O God, as we gather, family, friends, colleagues, loved ones.
Prayers there underway for William Rehnquist. You can join our conversation in this hour. Can you feel the ground moving under the High Court? Are you comfortable with John Roberts in the top seat, maybe for 30 years or more? And who or what kind of candidate are you expecting as the second nominee? President Bush says he most admires Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Who's in that vein? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this hour by Patrick Schiltz, professor and founding dean of the University of St. Thomas College of Law, a clerk for Justice Scalia in the Supreme Court in 1986, and from Washington by Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. Patrick Schiltz, a sad moment there in the Great Hall of the Supreme Court, and family and friends clearly pondering mortality and the loss of a loved one and a close colleague.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's hard for me, and I think anybody who's worked at the court the last 30 years to think of the place without Chief Justice Rehnquist there. He has been there for a very, very long time.
And at the end, when he was so feisty, saying to reporters who asked him when he would retire, that's for me to know and you to find out, do you have a sense of his attitude toward his role and job in those final months?
Well, that was It was classic Rehnquist. That was his personality. I mean, I took that press release to basically be saying, get off my lawn and leave me alone, which is what I think he was saying. I mean, I think I had talked to a number of people who had seen him this summer and, you know, knew him or knew his children, and it was clear that he was failing. I don't think his death came as a surprise. I think everybody expected it in the next few weeks. But that was classic Rehnquist. He was an intensely private man, and he had sort of had a gruff facade to the public, although in person he was a very warm, very humorous guy.
Jonathan Turley, John Roberts is widely seen somehow generally in this vein, as you say, a staunch conservative, but in demeanor, a mild man who seems capable of that same kind of moderate interaction.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing to watch how the White House has handled the Roberts nomination. It's been perfectly brilliant how they have packaged John Roberts. And, you know, in many of his views are not that different from Bob Bork. If you shave off the beard and make him a little more user-friendly and camera-friendly, you've got John Roberts in areas like affirmative action and abortion. But Bork was much, much more out there. He spoke his mind, and he had more of a record. And really his personality was such that telling Bob Bork not to comment on his past views would have been futile. And I say that to Bob Bork's advantage and to his credit. But, you know, what we know now about John Roberts is pretty consistent. You know, when he cut his teeth in the Reagan administration, all the way to the present day, he has indicated a very consistent view about the role of government and the role of courts on issues like abortion, affirmative action, environmental causes, access to the courts. He tends to be very, very, very conservative.
Be more specific when you compare him to Robert Bork without the beard. Bork was described as a potential justice who would roll back years of precedent, who would reshape our understanding of the Constitution and its intent in a fundamental way. Do you put John Roberts in that category, and would you classify him the same way, Jonathan Turley?
I do, and I think part of the phenomenon here is how we have changed politically. When Bork came up, his views were taken as quite radical and breathtaking. Issues like federalism, states' rights, that have now become more acceptable, and you have to give credit, at least partial credit, to Bill Rehnquist for that. I mean, he really stayed on that court and changed its focus. Its center of gravity moved to the right, and Rehnquist had two things that were I think good lessons for John Roberts. He was consistently conservative and remained so. It did not change much, and he was extremely patient. You know, Rehnquist was willing to wait. And he was willing to build a majority. And he slowly chipped away at Warren-era doctrines. And many times he brought down those doctrines by 1,000 paper cuts. He would just tweak it and tweak it and tweak it. To the end, you know, people say, well, look, the Miranda survived with Rehnquist's vote.
Mm-hmm.
Miranda didn't survive. He created so many exceptions to Miranda, he didn't care whether it survived or not.
Patrick Schultz, how about it? We see the moderate interaction, the manager in William Rehnquist. In John Roberts, Jonathan Turley says he sees that moderation, plus the conservative fire of a Robert Bork, who would fundamentally reorient the country around the Constitution. Do you see that as a more conservative observer?
Well, I knowing both men, I think they're very different guys. I think I would compare Bork more with, say, Clarence Thomas, which is a kind of a conservative activist, someone who is willing to, if you see opinions in the U.S. reports, former Supreme Court opinions, willing to rip them out of the books or to take the pen to them. Whereas I see Roberts more as an incrementalist, as a minimalist. I think he generally is suspicious of the exercise of federal judicial power and thinks that unless there's clear warrant in the Constitution to interfere, that the American people should essentially govern themselves and make important decisions for themselves. And my guess is that the biggest place you'll see the difference is I think Roberts will be less inclined to overturn prior precedents. It may be, as Jonathan said, that he'll do that over a period of 30 years through 1,000 paper cuts. I suspect it'll be more along the lines of not growing doctrines or rights that he disagrees with, but I doubt he'll be as willing as Bork would have been to go back and overturn them.
But if he leads the court, sits on the court and leads the court for 20, 30, conceivably 40 years, do you see a reshaped understanding of the Constitution on the other side of what could be an ocean of time here, a prior precedent overturned with time?
I say this not to be sarcastic, but if you could tell me who O'Connor's replacement is going to be, it would be a lot easier to answer that question. I mean, Roberts is going to be very similar to Rehnquist in the votes he cast. In fact, when he was nominated, when I would be interviewed about him, I would say the closest comparison I could come up with on the current court is Rehnquist. So we have a court today that, assuming Roberts gets confirmed, that is basically the court we've had for the last 10 or 15 years, which, as I said, has not handed conservatives a major victory in a hot-button case in years. The O'Connor replacement is going to be much more important, and eventually, of course, the Stevens replacement are going to be much more important as far as where the court goes 30 years from now.
Jonathan Turley, you speak to the Sandra Day O'Connor seat at this point. It's a kind of confusing calculus here. She's the centrist, very often the swing vote. Nominated to replace her was John Roberts, as you say, profoundly conservative, though with this mild demeanor. Now he's moved into the Rehnquist spot, Rehnquist politics perhaps much more like his own. Does that mean that President Bush will feel obligated to put a centrist up to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, or is he likely to come in with one of the potentially even more flamboyantly conservative nominees in the wings?
You know, Tom, this is the situation now in the Beltway is the most uncertain I've ever seen it. As you know, these decisions have a very heavy political patina. And you throw into this mix the rising criticism of the administration over the hurricane relief, the fact that he's now, as you say, shifted a conservative to a conservative slot, and the fact that he's got a good friend and a legacy appointment, possibly, in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. All of those things create a lot of unknowns for the White House. It certainly is easier to get Roberts through to fill a conservative spot because it seems like a swap one for one.
Right.
It's also easier because I don't think the Democrats are going to get any traction to put up a concentrated fight. And the president can certainly go to his conservative groups and say, look, I just delivered a staunchly conservative guy for Chief Justice. I should be able to put in my pal, Alberto Gonzalez, who would be the first Hispanic on the court. And I think a lot of people in the city are betting more heavily on Gonzalez. All of these things have certainly worked to his advantage. He's not liked by conservative groups, although I do think that they are giving him a raw deal. I mean, everything that the conservative groups point to, I don't think necessarily mean that Alberto Gonzalez is as moderate as they say he is.
But he was never a hard bar against abortion.
Well, but you can easily look at that and say that he was being a good jurist. He was following what he believed was the requirements of the Supreme Court and the requirements of state law. You know, we've also seen from Alberto Gonzalez and things like the torture memo a pretty radical view of presidential powers. Now, he did ultimately rescind his support of that memo. But few people, I think, would have, a few lawyers that I know would have signed that memo because it had some pretty shocking legal statements in it.
We'll talk about others who might be in that line, Patrick Schiltz, Jonathan Turley, but I want to begin to bring our callers in. Robert is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. I actually feel the same way as what you your guests have been saying. I think that Roberts is about the best that Democrats can hope for, given the circumstances. Unlike Scalia, he's not frothing at the mouth, and unlike Thomas, he's actually was rated highly by the ABA. And so I think that the Democrats would do well to not make a big stink about this and save their energies for when Bush is going to appoint somebody like Owens in the future.
Not too distant future, with Sandra Day O'Connor's position now awaiting a nominee. Robert, are you confident that that the Democrats will be able to leverage President Bush to a centrist or more moderate candidate for that O'Connor seat?
I'm sorry, who are you talking to?
You there in Burlington,
oh,
Robert.
I'm sorry, I don't know how to respond. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with the O'Connor seat, and that's that's just in the future. It depends on who Bush nominates, and I'm sorry, I don't know exactly how to respond to the question.
Let us pick it up with Patrick Schiltz in Minneapolis, and thanks for your call, Robert. Patrick Schiltz, what about the pressures that are likely to be on President Bush for the second nominee here? Will he feel, given how he's sort of come into tougher political waters, particularly in recent weeks between rough progress in the war and now the kind of scandal almost, or at least outrage over the handling of Katrina, is he going to feel that he has to moderate his target for the nominee that he puts up?
I don't know. It's a tough one. I totally agree with what Jonathan said about the confusion in the Beltway. I have talked to a number of friends in the White House and in the Justice Department, and this is just a real tough one for the president. You can make the argument, as you've just done, that given the other political problems he's had, the need to spend his political capital on other things, that he should go with a consensus or a moderate candidate. At the same time, the group that's keeping him afloat is his conservative base. The conservative base has gone out there and bled for this guy for 5 years now, 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And they did so that the day that Sandra Day O'Connor walked off the court, he wouldn't replace her with Sandra Day O'Connor the second, but he would replace her with somebody who would move the court to the right. So you could make the argument that by choosing another O'Connor to replace O'Connor, he'll be betraying the people who are standing by him in his time of need. It's a very, very hard call for this president right now, I think.
No easy path at the moment. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Christine is calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I have a question, and I'm not a lawyer, so my question may be roundabout. If this were, I'd like to help, so I have some help in defining conservatism with a reference to the past. If it were after the Civil War and the amendments that helped gave more freedoms and
enfranchisement, yep.
Yeah, enfranchisement, thank you. I'm very nervous. To African Americans were to be reviewed by a conservative in today's Supreme Court, or if it were 1954 or 1964, how would conservatives who are now being considered, how would they view those different legislative moves?
Christina, we've got it, and that's terrific. Our time is short before the break. But Jonathan Turley, here's the kind of, you know, question from the heart that I think a lot of Americans, whatever their standing, simply want to know, does this mean a rollback on the kind of liberalizing decisions of the court of the kind Christina describes? Would John Roberts and a potential second Bush nominee actually want to put those aside, make those history?
I doubt that. I think that John Roberts is not frothing, as someone said, although that might be stylistic in the long run. He is not someone who would reinvent the federal courts. But I have been cautioning, even though I think that John Roberts is extremely qualified, I think that he will, if he gets a good conservative to replace O'Connor, lead that court in significant rollbacks. There is a breathtaking number of doctrines that are currently dangling by a single vote, and that vote was more often than not Sandra Day O'Connor's. So if she is replaced by a conservative, you could see very significant changes across the board.
We'll come back and look at those doctrines dangling. But Patrick Schiltz, on the big question, the complexion of the kind of rights that our caller Christine asks about, do you see them going away?
I guess the short answer is no, I don't see them going away. We use conservative to really refer to two very different types of judges. There are conservative judges who are politically conservative judges, who are activists, who want to use judicial power to accomplish conservative political goals. I do not think that is John Roberts. There are other conservatives that I would call judicial conservatives, who believe that, as I said, that the American people, as much as possible, should be able to make their own decisions unless there's clearly warrant in the Constitution for the judiciary to interfere. I think that is more John Roberts. I think he's more a judge who will step aside and let the democratic process make more decisions than perhaps a political conservative would, who would impose politically conservative views through the judiciary.
Of course, even that, an issue of some debate. George Will saying recently, watch out for majoritarian views. on the court. Patrick Schiltz in Minneapolis, Jonathan Turley in Washington, please stand by. We're talking about the end of the Supreme Court's Rehnquist era. You can join us. Will we have a hard redefining of the court to the right? What will that mean for your rights? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the end of the Supreme Court's Rehnquist era and the John Roberts nomination for Chief Justice, now two seats open on the High Court. Yesterday, President Bush announced the nomination of John Roberts to shift from the Sandra Day O'Connor seat, where she's saying she's ready to go, and he had been aimed, to the place of Justice William Rehnquist. John Roberts is 50. As a young man, he clerked for Justice Rehnquist. The president spoke to that at the White House.
25 years ago, John Roberts came to Washington as a clerk to Justice William Rehnquist. In his boss, the young law clerk found a role model, a professional mentor, and a friend for life. I'm certain that Chief Justice Rehnquist is hoping to welcome John Roberts as a colleague. We're all sorry that day didn't come.
A memorial service complete today for William Rehnquist in the Supreme Court Great Hall. You can join our conversation this hour. What are your hopes and fears for a John Roberts court? And are we now destined for a more conservative court, a more conservative America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour from Minneapolis by Patrick Schiltz, professor and founding dean at the University of St. Thomas College of Law in St. Paul. From Washington by Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. And right now from Washington as well by Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He will be covering the John Roberts hearings, have one of the coveted seats inside when those now begin. Charles, tell us, what, next week?
We believe it'll be Monday, that's right.
So they were intended to go forward today. The Bush White House reportedly was very determined to do that in spite of everything. It has not happened. Why?
Well, I think they were going to take some time out for the funeral services for Judge Rehnquist, but the one reason that Republicans would like to keep moving is that, you know, delay is the enemy of the team that's ahead, if you will, and they felt that the Roberts nomination has been on track all along. They've done a nice job of lining this thing up, and it looks like, he barring any unforeseen bombshell, he should go through. So, you know, anything that might delay or hamper is seen as possibly problematic, although I don't think anybody sees that as a perhaps a serious problem. But the more it can stay on track as far as the Republicans are concerned, the better.
The president's pushing hard on that. He has said he would like to see John Roberts on the court when it opens its new session. Remind us of the calendar here.
Right. October 3 is when the new session begins. Tom, there should be enough time. I think both Democrats and Republicans say that there was a week of give in the schedule, if you will. What they will do is next week have a week of hearings for Roberts. Should be able to take care of that in 1 week. The Judiciary Committee will vote the next week on whether to recommend him to the full Senate, and that would still give them a couple of weeks to debate and vote in time to have him on the court, if he's confirmed, as people expect, in time. So the Democrats could try to drag this thing out, but if they do, you know, then they are subject to criticism that they prevented the court from getting started on time with a full complement of justices.
And what about the Sandra Day O'Connor opening? If she wades into this new session, is she then obligated to finish it? How does that play out?
You know, your law professors might know a little better than that, but my understanding is that a justice who hears a case then you, of course, has the right to vote on that case. But if that justice is not still on the court when that case is decided, and obviously they're often, you know, officially decided weeks or months after they're heard, then that justice would not be able to vote. So what they would like to do is whatever cases that Justice O'Connor hears, that she would vote on and wrap up that portion of the court's hearings for whatever period she's on the court.
And Charles, you're the reporter among us here in the field. What are you hearing about President Bush's thinking, or the White House thinking, toward that second seat? Alberto Gonzalez's name is easily and often put at the top of the list. There's an issue of how conservative or centrist he goes with the second nominee now. Is there anything leaking out?
No, there's not anything leaking out, and I'll confess I don't have special insight into the president's thinking. I thought Jonathan Turley handicapped it pretty well. What we do know of President Bush, a couple of things. He has a strong sense of loyalty. He likes to deal with people he's known a long time, and another thing is he certainly is interested in drawing more Hispanics and African-Americans, for that matter, into the Republican fold, and both of those would argue for someone like Alberto Gonzalez. But on the other hand, he clearly, in any number of ways, has shown that he wants to do dramatic things. You know, sometimes tax cuts is a good example, but sometimes he goes further and more dramatically in his policy than some people might expect, and that might argue for someone more conservative. Either way, you got to remember the president has a lot of power, and we can talk a lot about conservatives with his own party griping or whatever, but in the end, it's really hard to deny the president what he wants.
His own calculation. Charles Babington, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. I hope we hear from you again when these hearings do begin. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Sue is calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. If Roberts, like Bork, does not believe that the Constitution gives the right of privacy to citizens of this country, how could Professor Turley give me some practical examples of how Roberts' decisions might affect all of us?
Sue, may I ask you, when you raise the right of privacy, are you raising it particularly in regard to abortion rights or more broadly?
I'm raising it in general. I think that's how Bork raised it. It wasn't just abortion rights. He said the right of privacy.
Let me put that to both of our guests, and thank you for your call. Jonathan Turley, first to you on the issue of privacy. What do we know about where John Roberts stands and how it might change policy?
Well, that's an excellent question. I write for USA Today, and we all put together questions last week that we would ask Roberts, and mine was indeed the very question that was raised. That is, does he recognize a right of privacy? And if he does, where in the Constitution is it found? If you take a look at his past statements and papers, you do not get a sense of someone who is very supportive of a broad understanding of privacy when it comes to things like gay rights or abortion. He indeed said that Roe v. Wade was, quote, wrongly decided. And he has also called abortion a tragedy. He encouraged the appointment of pro-life judges when he was working in the administration. And more importantly, he has said he's referred to abortion as based on the, quote, so-called right to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether indeed those reflect his current views, we'll have to see. But certainly, throughout his career, he has seemed rather antagonistic towards this amorphous concept of privacy that the court has built so much around.
Patrick Schultz, how do you see that? We're told that these are often arguments that John Roberts put together for whomever he was working for in whatever administration. Do you think, you know him well, do these represent his personal view? Is he antagonistic to the right of privacy as the court has construed it now for some decades?
Well, I've never discussed it with him, so I want to be clear about that. I'm just basing my guesses on what we've all read in the papers and just general knowledge of him. There's several layers of questions here. Layer one is, would he, as an original matter, find a right of privacy or a right of abortion in the Constitution? My guess is no. My guess is, had he been sitting on the court in 1972 or 1973, he would have dissented in Roe versus Wade. Second question, it's no longer 1972 or 1973, it's now 30 years later. Would he overrule a decision that has already been challenged several times at the Supreme Court, has been reaffirmed several times, that has really become part of the fabric of American life? That's a much more difficult question. I have no idea what the answer to that is. Third layer is, if he wouldn't overrule it, what happens when various parties show up and seek to expand the doctrine or change the doctrine or extend the doctrine to cover new things? And again, I don't know the answer to that question. And finally, I think, keep in mind here, your caller was asking, I understood her to be asking very specifically about what's the impact on my life.
if the Supreme Court were to overturn Roe versus Wade tomorrow, that doesn't mean that abortion becomes illegal in 50 states. It means that it's up to the states to decide. And there are states like my own in Minnesota here where our state Supreme Court has held not just that abortion is protected by our state constitution, but that the taxpayers are required constitutionally to fund it in the state of Minnesota. In most of the states of the country, New York and Massachusetts and California and Illinois, the legal regime wouldn't change at all. The legislature would continue to allow abortion. So, it's not as simple as saying Roberts thumbs up or thumbs down on abortion. It's a much, much more complex question than that.
But there has been that Supreme Court guarantee standing there for a long time. Patrick, just let me ask you, on this front, you say you don't know what John Roberts thinks about it in particular, even though you've known him for a long time. He was to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, now nominated as Chief Justice. Does that raise the bar for disclosure here? Should he be obligated or more obligated to be more forthcoming about where he stands on issues that may come before the court than before, with this new prominence that he is nominated to the role he's nominated to play?
Oh, well, I know is my answer to the question. I mean, I think that whatever questions he should have asked as O'Connor's replacement, he should answer as Rehnquist's replacement, and whatever questions he should have declined to answer as O'Connor's replacement, he should continue to decline to answer. The things that he's concerned about, the appearance of fairness, the appearance not to be making commitments to the Senate about views, all those continue to be valid concerns even if he's nominated for the chief. So we can argue about where those lines are, but I don't think the lines shift because he's now Rehnquist's replacement instead of O'Connor's.
Let's hear from some more of our callers. Mark is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Hello, Mark. Are you there, my friend? Looks like we've lost Mark. Let me turn to another call. Jose is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Jose, you're on the air.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. I'm very concerned about the direction of the court because, I think, especially as it concerns the privacy issue, because I think we, all of our citizens in America, we do have a right to privacy. I don't care what nobody says, and the Constitution does imply that we have a right to privacy. I don't care what the people say, because it says something about people have a right to be left alone in their own person. That's implying privacy to me, sir.
And what face of privacy are you concerned about losing? Are you thinking about abortion? Are you thinking about gay rights? Are you thinking about just privacy in your home?
Privacy in general, sir. You know they want to pass this. What they call the? What was the act they passed? The terrorist attack. The
Patriot Act.
Patriot Act. And all that. That takes away some rights right there. And stuff. And certainly personal rights. And in wartime, I understand us relinquishing some rights, but just to be releasing them just because somebody like Roberts or whoever was on the court. I'm not in favor of that at all.
There's a big no thank you from Columbia, South Carolina to any diminishment there. Jonathan Turley, let me put the same question to you about what John Roberts should be obligated to respond to, especially now that he's headed for the top chair on the court. Democrats, many, are still saying, we want more. We want more a more forthcoming process than we've had in recent nominations. Is there any prospect of that here? Is there an obligation for him to be more open here?
Well, there is no obligation for him. The Constitution is silent on what a senator can demand for his or her vote. Ultimately, a senator can premise their vote on the condition that answers are given to questions asked, and that absent those answers, the senator will vote against the nominee. The framers left it to each senator to decide. And for Roberts, however, I think the dimension is different. I think that Karl Rove effectively walked him outside to Capitol Hill and showed him the chalk, marks of Bob Bork's body.
Don't go here.
That's right. But for the grace of God, go you. This is a nomination for you to lose. And if you want to have this cathartic moment of answering questions, do so, and you may end up on the appellate court for the rest of your career. And so there's no question what the advice is. Now, in terms of whether it's appropriate for them to ask questions, I think it is appropriate. It's not appropriate for them to say, look, Smith versus Williams is going to be in front of the court in October. How are you going to vote? But it is perfectly appropriate for them to say, do you believe there is a right of privacy in the Constitution? And does that right extend, for example, to the consensual private acts of adults in their home. That's a type of general question that goes to his view of the law. He can refuse to answer that, and then the repercussions of that refusal are left to each senator.
Mark is calling from Cedar Rapids. We've got you back, Mark. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. My thoughts on Mr. Roberts are, you know, let him go through and do what he's supposed to do. You know, he's obviously been around the horn. He understands the system. Everybody understands him. He worked for Mr. Rehnquist, for God's sake.
Right.
And he is a conservative, I think, by nature. And that's okay. As I explained to your the gal who answered your phone there.
Yeah.
You know, it's better to be, you know, like they always say, be a little more conservative, because people who stick their nose out too fast usually get it snapped off and everybody gets paying the price.
But what if conservatism means a diminishment in rights to privacy? For example, sexual behavior in your own home, Mark. Are you concerned about that, or you welcome a tighter national rein on that?
I don't welcome a tighter rein on that at all. I think that we need to go back to our roots. You know, a wise man once said, look in the past, it'll tell you about your future. And I think our past has been pretty much obliterated the past 20 or 30 years. We need to really go back, not to be, you know, archaic about it, but we need to go back to some morals, some basics, some standards. You know, as a simple example, you look at the theater people right now, they're all saying how grateful they are that summer is over, because it was the worst movie year they've had since 1973. Well, look at the stuff they're putting out. You know, we keep getting more and more aggressive, more and more liberal out there, and get more and more junk on the movie screen. Parents don't take it to the kids. I don't take my children some of this stuff that's out there. Disney's really gotten off the ham.
And in that, we can hear the lines drawn by Americans, right, from whatever emanates from the court all the way to the commercial movie theaters. Mark, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Patrick Schiltz, we've just got a minute left here. Do you see this kind of going back? I mean, in some way, that's essentially what's being debated here with these two openings. Do you welcome, like Mark apparently would, a kind of going back to a more conservative guidance from the high court?
Well, I don't see. You know, the choice isn't you have privacy home in your home and you don't, or you don't have privacy in the home. The choice is who decides how much privacy in your home you have. Is it unelected judges on the Supreme Court, or is it the legislatures that you elect, that you choose to make those decisions
but
for?
But that's
you.
A huge now, choice, and not as obvious an answer as you seem to suggest. I mean, minority rights have been crucial to our understanding of what the Constitution protects, haven't they?
Right, and I was just going to say, sometimes the answer is, I want the 9 unelected judges to make those decisions, because I you know, the Constitution is meant to take certain things out of majority control, absolutely. But I'm just saying, when you pose the question to the caller of either you do have freedom in your bedroom or you don't have freedom in your bedroom based upon the 9 justices, it's not that simple. There are other players in the political process that have a role. In terms of what I see happening, I don't see major changes no matter what happens, because remember the justices, as they say, read the newspapers too. The justices can't get too far out of whack of the general population. And
well, we'll see. But with two changing, it could be a large change, certainly in the faces on the court. And I'm afraid with that, we're out of time. Patrick Schiltz at the University of St. Thomas College of Law, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
And Jonathan Turley, George Washington University, a terrific observer. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.